Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. I've been a cop for 27 years. I like to say I got a backstage pass to life. Well, guess what? I got some tickets for you. So come on in, pull up a chair, turn up that volume, and let's go. Chasing Justice is on.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Chasing Justice. I'm your host, Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. Now, there is a lot going on in our country and in the world. We are seeing chaos here in the United States. We are seeing the prices of food and supplies and everything that we use every single day that we take for granted when times are good. We're now seeing not only are they in short supply, but the ones that are around are extremely expensive. Take gasoline. In most places now, over $4 a gallon. In some places, even higher. Well, one of the things that we all need is fuel, and our country has been shut down by fuel. We don't make our own fuel. We have to buy fuel from people who don't care for us, people who hate us. And the price has gone through the roof. Well, we got to figure, if you are on a fixed income or you have you make the median income, let's say the median income in the United States is $60,000 a year. And that's probably high if you took in the entire country. But let's say $60,000. Now you add to that an additional $50 or $60 per week of your expendable income to pay for gasoline to continue your life. That's going to put a hurt on you. When you look at the cost of building supplies, you know, I'm redoing a bathroom and we're buying all the supplies ourselves. I'm doing the work. I'm up there with a hammer and nails and screwdrivers. The wood, a sheet of plywood, has come down in recent months. Normally, a good sheet of 3/4 inch plywood is about $35 a sheet. Now that would escalate to $40 a sheet, $38 a sheet. It'll go up and down, but it was around $35 a sheet. Well, at the height of the pandemic, it was $110 a sheet. Well, now I just went the other day. I had to buy 2 sheets of 3/4 inch plywood for my bathroom project, and they were $78 a piece here in New Jersey. $78. You think about the cost of that, about building a home. 2x4s that are normally $3.50 were $7.50. And these are just tiny little fractions of things that we use all the time. Food. How much does your food cost you now when you're going out there? You know, a package of 4 chicken breasts used to be, $7, $8, maybe $10. Now it's $16, $17 for 4 pieces of chicken. The expense that's going on here in our country is horrific. We look at the chaos around the world. We see what Russia is doing in Ukraine and how that's going to affect the cost of things, prices of food. Apparently, they're calling Ukraine the breadbasket of the world. They make they grow a lot of wheats and grains and whatnot. Well, so does the United States. But the price there is going up because production has basically come to a halt. You can't get supplies. They're having a hard time farming. They're in the middle of this war. And it's affecting all of us. And it could be pushing us towards several things. The big concern is that somebody will make some kind of miscalculation over there, and we will end up in World War III, drawing other nations in. Along that line, I did read a report recently that because the Ukrainian military and the people of the country are fighting back so strongly that they've actually now initiated an attack on Russia. They did some bombing in a couple of cities, missile attacks. The Ukrainians didn't hit an ammunition depot. Now, it hasn't been confirmed that it's the Ukrainians, but who else would it be, you know, that would shoot into Russia? So that's an interesting turnabout, because everybody says, oh, Russia, their Russian army is so powerful, they're going to wipe them out. And I think we talked about this in a previous episode that, you know, some people are sitting around waiting to see where's the big plan from Putin here. What's he going to roll in? Where's his reserves to go take over this country? So maybe he can't do it. Maybe he's getting pushed back. There's reports that he's getting pushed out of Kiev or whatever they're calling it these days. Is that possible? That this mighty Russian military is being defeated again, just like the Mujahideen defeated them over the course of time. They couldn't beat the Afghanistan. Now, we didn't have a lot of luck there either. We did pacify the country pretty much. But, you know, the Russians got thrown out of Afghanistan as well because they could not overcome the people there. So we're seeing this again now in Ukraine. So, hey, good for the people of Ukraine. You know, if they're able to fight back and push them out, they've suffered terribly. They've lost thousands of people. Their cities are lying in smoking ruins. They've lost children, elderly people. It's absolutely horrifying what happens there. But that's an interesting development that's going on. We really got to watch this closely over there. You know, there's my Arthur. There he is, our rescue boy. He likes to run outside and say hi to all the neighbors. It's awesome. This is a question that I wanted to pose. One of the things I want to talk about this week, and this is, I want to ask all of you to think for a minute and ask this question. Can we change? As individuals, can we completely change the road that we're on and go a different direction? Especially if we've had difficulty or we've done some bad things in our past. Maybe our lifestyle was drinking. Can you really change a drinking history and be sober? Now, we know that people do it. It's not easy. Can you stop smoking cigarettes, right? Can you really cut down on your cigarette use or whatever it is, or drug use, right? We're seeing huge amounts of drug abuse. Can you change this? Now, that sounds like willpower, doesn't it? It's a willpower kind of a thing. Maybe some medical, so you can change where you are, what you're doing. You got to have the desire to do it. And it's a lot of hard work. But I'm talking about something different. I'm talking about the kind of change that is unusual. And let me be specific. I don't want to beat around the bush. There's a project I'm working on right now, and it centers around that question. Can someone actually change? So as you all know, I like to write. I write lots of different things. I write informational books. I write some different kind of training manuals. I do a lot of writing. I write articles for lots of different publications. I'm working on a project now that I'm trying to get together. It's probably about 65% ready to go, but I still have some more preparation to do. And that is specifically, I'm working with former serial killer David Berkowitz, also known as the Son of Sam. Now, many of you might be too young to remember the Son of Sam. His killing spree took place in the late 1970s in New York City. He would walk around Lover's Lanes, and using a .44 caliber handgun, he would shoot into cars and kill young people who were sitting in Lover's Lanes parking. He killed quite a few people. Injured quite a few more, and destroyed the lives of many people. But the biggest thing was he put the city of New York and the surrounding areas in absolute terror. That summer of 1977 was absolute terror. I was 14 or 15 years old, and I remember being scared to death that the Son of Sam was going to get us, you know, and we were 60, 70 miles away. When he was finally captured, that was something that was a relief to everyone. And if you didn't live through that time, you don't remember. New York was in really bad shape. Crime, it was a miserable place to be. And here was this serial killer, Son of Sam, who was taking instruction from his dog and the devil and all kinds of things to go out and kill young people. Well, if you've noticed on some of the streaming services, TV services, like I believe it's Netflix, has a program out now. Recounting it. You have all these investigators who are looking at the evidence from back in the day and saying, hey, there was more to this. There was more people involved than just him, than David Berkowitz. It was an entire satanic type of cult group that was out doing all these things. Never been any direct proof of that. David Berkowitz was captured. He was tried and he was convicted, and he's serving multiple consecutive life terms in upstate New York, in a prison. Well, as it happens, from one of our guys from the neighborhood, you know, Bill Dallas, the man of faith, Bill Dallas, who will be back on with us soon, you know, as the pandemic wears away, the guys in the neighborhood really want to come back, and we miss them all, and we'll get them back. But anyway, Bill and his pastor, Pastor Cliff, made a visit to David Berkowitz in upstate New York. So I don't know the connection there, but I know that the pastor has been counseling David for many years, and he brought Bill with him on a visit. Well, Bill told me he was going up there, and I was kind of shocked. Like, this is somebody, first of all, a nefarious individual, the Son of Sam killer, in prison, and he's been out of the public eye for many, many years. It comes up every once in a while. You know, we're in the anniversary this summer, that hot summer of 1977. The different movies come out about the Son of Sam killer, and there's a lot of unanswered questions there are in the investigation. But a lot of it is conjecture, people coming up with things to write new books, to make new Netflix series and that kind of thing. But they went up to visit this guy, and Bill came back and told me about it. And first of all, I said, well, you sat with a serial killer. What's it like? He says, actually, he seems to be a completely changed individual. He has found God. He has found Jesus. And he has now dedicated his life behind bars, which he will never get out. There's no chance of him being paroled or being released ever. David Berkowitz will die in prison. He's not getting out. There's no chance of that. But he says he has now found God, and he's trying to turn his own personal life around from the evil that he perpetrated and the terror that he perpetrated on people. So I had an idea. I said, first of all, I would like to really understand that story. And it's not every day you have a connection to somebody like this. So I wrote a letter to him. Bill gave me the address, and I wrote a letter to David Berkowitz, and he responded. I got to tell you, it's really a strange thing to see this letter come in the mail with the name of a serial killer on it from prison, knowing that this is the guy that had everyone paralyzed in fear, myself including, as a young person. And he's nefarious. He's like one of these people who's, when you rattle off the names of these serial killers, Ted Bundy, the BTK killer guy, and you got Son of Sam. You know, I mean, it's pretty bizarre to be in contact with that person. But I wrote this letter to him, and I basically said, I think there is value in your story. There is some redemptive value in your story of what has happened to you since you went to prison, since you were convicted of this terrible crime spree. I think that maybe many people can listen to your story and not necessarily see David in a different way, but maybe can understand that if God can come to him in his life, and he could find a place there, he could change his way of going, then maybe that can happen for anybody who's out there looking for redemptive kind of processes. So the first thing, I have concerns. Number one, is he genuine? Is he genuine in his conversion from evil to good, I guess, would be the easiest way to put it. Is this all real, or is he simply doing this? Well, the first way to answer that is to say to yourself, what would be the motivation? You know, why would people do something like this? Well, the easiest answer is that you would be doing it if you got a benefit. So the first benefit you would think of if you're sitting in prison for many, many, many years, and he's been there since 1977. He's already been there for, 40-something years? And he's going to be there forever. The benefit would be, hey, if I show a little remorse, I say I'm sorry, I say I found God, maybe I get out of prison. And I get to go back to normal life. That would really be the reason someone would do this. But that's not a possibility for David. He is not getting out at all. And it's even funny, in my own words, as I talk about him, initially, when I started this project, I was calling him Son of Sam, Son of Sam, Son of Sam. But now we've corresponded 3 or 4 letters back and forth. And hearing what he's writing in the letters, seeing what he's portraying that he's doing, for me personally, I'm now calling him David, which is, it's bizarre in itself. Even for me, I thought it was strange that Bill knew an individual like this, but now I know this individual. And I have a connection to him through these letters, and I'm trying to convince him to let me tell his story. So one of the first things I did is when I wrote that letter, I didn't know how it would be received. I didn't know what he would think about it. Would he think I'm just another one of these people that's trying to exploit him and use him for their own gain, as lots of these people do? It's interesting, I found out that he told me he shut down after the first letter. He says, I don't talk to anybody usually from like May until October. I don't take visitors, I don't do anything, because all he gets is inundated with people who want to talk to him about the murders. that want to talk to him about the Satanism that he was supposed to be a part of and all that. And he says, and that's, you know, that's past in my life. That's not what my life is now. And because it's the anniversary, the summer of terror, that he gets inundated. So therefore, he shuts off contact until the fall again. Because you get past the anniversary. It was the summertime. It happened, you know, across the summer, July and August of 1977. So I found that interesting. Well, I got this letter. And he says, listen, I get the idea. I would like to tell my story, my conversion story. But I'm not really sure. I have to think about it. What are you thinking about doing? How are you thinking about doing it? So my response letter was, I said, understanding the guy's point of view, that he doesn't want to rehash the story again. You know, there's countless stories told about his crimes, and that's really the titillating part. That's what everybody wants to hear. These murders, and how did he do it, and, you know, what's up with the dog? Did the dog really talk to him? That's the questions everybody really wants to ask. And in all honesty, as a investigator, as a criminal investigator, I would like to have that conversation as well. I'm not gonna pretend I wouldn't. You know, there's more to learn from what he did. Now the detectives who worked the case back in the day, there's controversy. This is what the new television series is about. That apparently there was a lot of information that David didn't act alone. That he was part of a group who was doing this. A satanic group that was doing these killings. But after he got caught, they all kind of went silent and disappeared. Well, you know, you got to look at something like that and say, if this was a committed group of these crazy people, they would have surfaced somewhere else. They would have popped up somewhere else. They would have continued a year later, 2 years later, in anonymity and continued their killing spree. And they never did. Which leads me to believe that, like most conspiracy theories, there's some truth to the information, but mostly it's a simple thing to say, this didn't happen. He acted alone. He was a man who had a problem, a mental problem. He had a personality problem, and he acted out. So that's kind of where I went back with him. I said, I want to pick up where your story picks up after the murders. I don't want to talk about the murders per se. Because first of all, I figure he probably doesn't want to do that. You know, he's pretty clear about that. He doesn't like talking about it. He wanted to move on. So I wanted to focus on that question. Is it possible to really change? Can somebody like David Berkovitz, the Son of Sam killer, can he really change and have a conversion? You know, is it possible that God really did come into his life and speak to him and help him to move forward? Now, he has a website. I believe it's called Aspire to Heaven, I think it is, .org. And he goes on there. One of the things you'll find on there, interesting, is he does write a letter of apology to the families of his victims, because this is another concern I have. You know, did he ever have remorse? Did he ever say, now, what good does an apology do when they've killed your daughter or your son, right, when somebody's done that? But I think that is a necessary part of closure that people might need if something like that happened to a family member, that they actually got an apology from the killer, that the killer's not just out there still attacking them by not apologizing. And I don't always get that apology thing, I suppose, but, you know, it's part of our human nature, I guess, to want to be apologized to. You know, somebody does you wrong, you say you're sorry. So anyway, that was my conversation, and my response from David was, he's going to pray on it. He's going to think about it and decide if he wants to tell his story from the time he got to prison, his conversion, and what that means in his life. So I said, okay, this seemed like a good project, an interesting thing. You know, as a law enforcement guy, as a writer, I would find this really interesting. Well, then I got another letter from him. And it was after, I guess, his self-imposed break for the summer. And he said, I've been considering this writing project, and I'm really unsure what I want to do about it. Can you give me more concrete thoughts on what you're thinking of. So after that, I said, well, why don't I outline this a little bit? And what I would want to do is, without a doubt, like I said earlier, I do want to know more about what happened, what he did, if there is anything more to it. You know, I think that would be a possibility to find out. I'm a trained investigator. I'm an interview kind of guy. I do a lot of interviews, and I can pull information out of people. But I don't want to, strange as this sounds, I don't want to betray the trust that I'm laying out there, that I want to tell his story. But I think over the course of time, that other information may come out. Because what I had said in my letter, and trying to convince him, was that in my religious belief, you know, we can be forgiven by God for even the most heinous of things that we do if we're honestly and truly sorry for them. But there's more to it than that. You don't just, hey, I'm sorry. Oh, you're forgiven. Move on. There's also a responsibility. You have to take responsibility for what you've done, whether that be hurt somebody verbally, whether that be do something to wrong somebody, or if you kill a bunch of people. You know, you have to take responsibility for it. And you have to make it right in some way. You know, there is something you have to do. You can't just say, hey, please forgive me, and you're forgiven, and that's it, and you move on. There is more to it in my religious training. So I let him know that we've all done things. You know, we've all done things in our lives that we're sorry for. We've hurt people, maybe not killed them, but maybe we've hurt people very badly. Maybe you've betrayed somebody, something or other. And you might have this relationship with them. So how do you fix that? How do you go about fixing that? Well, you have to take responsibility for it, and you have to repent, and then maybe you have to do something to show you're honestly, you know, changing. So when I thought about that, if you remove the element of being a serial killer, mass serial killer, and you just look at the things that we could do to each other that are very painful, like I said, betraying somebody, cheating on somebody, stealing from somebody, talking behind their back, ruining their reputation, whatever it is. You know, we all know these things. What happens in the course of relationships and people you know. How would you make that right? How would you go about making that right? Well, you'd apologize, and then you'd have to show some action, right, to make it correct. So that's what I wanted David to know. I wanted him to know that, well, I believe that he may be on this path. He says he is. He says he's found this relationship. But his victims, I'm sure they're not whole still. They're much older now. The parents, so many of the parents of the kids who were killed are gone, because they were in their 40s at the time, and it's been 40-something years, so lots of them are gone. But there are other people around. And I thought by him telling his story, that if people could see that, and I could discern whether I felt he was being truthful or not in the course of the interview, that he might be able to do some bigger good. You know, it's good for him to do these things, to repent and to make better, asking for forgiveness. But it would also be good for people out there to hear this, that if a person like him, a guy who was involved in what he was involved in, what he did to people, if he can find his way back to the Lord our God, and he can find forgiveness and redemption, then we can all find redemption and forgiveness for what we've done. So recently, I was in church, and all this stuff kind of combines, because that's what this is about. It's my own personal journey of trying to understand my place in the world, in the universe. How do I deal with God? And this whole thing with David Berkowitz kind of has really upset my calm view of these things and made me look deeper. So if we look at it, we say, if he can be forgiven, then I can be forgiven. But what do I have to do, right, to make up for that? And what does he have to do? So that's really where I'm going with this project with him. So we left it at our most recent conversation that I sent him a list of questions. What I said, why don't we start out with an article? We'll write an article first that describes your journey. And a basic 10, 15 question thing. And I'll write the intro and the exit to it. And then we'll go from there. And basically, the bigger book would just simply hash out those details further in a bigger kind of a way. So I sent that off. And right now, I guess he's going to think about it and consider it and get back to me. And if it happens, that'll be a writing project that I'll be undertaking here this year and probably part of next year. So ask that question to yourself. do you think someone can really change the path they're on? Do you believe that someone like a David Berkowitz can really change who he was and become something better? Can he have a relationship with God after all he has done? And that's where we're going with the article. So I want to kind of clue you in on that. As soon as I get a response and I have the article, I'm pretty sure I will send it to the great Malcolm Out Loud on the America Out Loud radio network for him to put up on his site. So that covers that. I wanted you to know about that. What else is going on? What else is going on? Let's talk a little culture. We saw recently at the Oscar Awards. I don't know if you watch the Oscars. I don't watch the Oscars. I don't care about these self-involved people and all of their, you know, their self-righteousness and their nonsense that they pull. You know, everything is social justice, and not, I'm not against social justice. I'm against the nonsense that the way they go about it. But we had Chris Rock, very funny comedian, cutting edge kind of guy, and he's up there. He's making his commentary. And he looks over and he sees Will Smith and his wife, Jada Pinkett Smith. And apparently, Jada has a alopecia hair problem. Now, I didn't know she had that problem. I've seen lots of pictures of her. You know, you see pictures of her in the news and stuff. And I just thought she was, you know, doing one of those Sinead O'Connor kind of things, haircuts. You know, going down to a shaved head. That's, you know, you see a lot of people do that. Males and females. It's popular. I don't know why, but they seem to think it's a good thing. So I thought that's what she had done. You know, cut her hair like that. Making a statement, who knows, whatever. She's doing whatever. Well, it's not that. She actually has alopecia, and I give her a lot of credit. You know, it's one thing for a guy to lose his hair. I'm losing my hair. It's not comfortable. You don't feel good. You say, oh, you look stupid. You wish you had hair. But you learn to deal with it because it's a normal part of our existence, especially as men. You lose hair. When it comes to women losing their hair, and lots of them do, you know, lots of women lose a lot of hair, you know, it's from different things besides alopecia. It's very difficult for a woman to go out in public with a real problem hair thing. So, you know, it's a difficult. I didn't know she had that problem because I don't keep up on that kind of pop culture thing that much. But anyway, Chris Rock was up there making a joke when he saw her. I'm going to assume, and you remember what they used to say on Saturday Night Live, when you assume, you make an ass out of you and me. So who knows? Maybe I'm wrong here. But I think he looked over, and he assumed that it was a hairstyle. And he says, oh, I'm looking forward to the movie G.I. Jane. G.I. Jane 2 coming out, starring Jada Pinkett Smith, because she had shaved her head. And I think that's what he honestly thought, because why would you purposely go after someone you know who had a problem? Hey, how's that cancer going there, Bob? Hope you don't die too soon. You wouldn't say a thing like that. Nobody would say a thing like that. So I can't really believe that he would purposely attack her knowing she had this health issue. Well, when you watch the whole scene, as we all know what transpired next, is that at some point, Will Smith got up from his seat, walked up onto the stage during this live event, walked up to Chris Rock, and slapped him open-handed pretty hard in the face. And then he turned around and returned to his seat. Well, when he gets to his seat, Chris Rock didn't know what to do. I mean, he made a comment, hey, Will Smith just beat the heck out of me. And then Will Smith turned around and made some comments, you know, keep my wife's name out of your effing mouth. That was his comment. And there was confusion on everybody's part. What had just happened? What did we just see? Well, there's a couple of things here, and we'll talk about it here, and then when we get to the next segment, we'll finish it up. But there's two sides here. We're looking at some cultural things in here. You know, here this man's wife was insulted in public. Does he stand up for her, or does he just let it go? Does he take it as a joke at her expense? She obviously looked very uncomfortable when the joke was made. She scowled. She felt bad. I'm sure she was embarrassed to bring this to people's attention, because all the cameras, millions of people that were watching, focused in on her. And I guess Will Smith felt he had to do something to defend his wife's honor. So he got up and slapped this guy in the face. Now, is that the most appropriate thing he could have done? Should he have not done that? Should he have done it? I mean, if you're out in the bar and that happens, wouldn't you throw a punch if you had to? I don't know. So the cultural things are weird. There's so much going on. We'll be back in a minute with more Chasing Justice.
today's world, there's no escaping the headlines filled with warnings about emerging viruses and dangerous superbugs. Genesis is the only technology that safely and effectively obliterates harmful pathogens both in the air and on surfaces. Genesis plus HOCL neutralize these threats to your environment in just seconds. Find out more about this amazing technology at genesisfogger.com/outloud for a 15% discount. With Genesis, you'll be prepared for what's next.
Because of COVID-19, many Americans worry about their health 4 times a day. That's 120 times per month. To minimize the worries, leading nutritional supplement company, Healthy Cell, created Immune Super Boost, an immune supplement that contains full effective doses of science-backed nutrients like vitamin C, zinc, elderberry, and echinacea, all in a one-a-day, pill-free, ultra-absorption ingestible gel. It tastes great, comes in a convenient squeeze gel pack, and it's more natural too, without chemical binders, fillers, and coatings. Supporting a strong and resilient immune system can be simple. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Immune Super Boost. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
As Americans, we seek to form a more perfect union. To paraphrase Abraham Lincoln, we are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And God willing, we shall not perish from the earth. AmericaOutloud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
All right, welcome back to Chasing Justice here on the America Out Loud Radio Network. You know, where did we leave off? We were talking about the cultural ramifications of the Will Smith slap to the face of Chris Rock, the comedian. So as a husband myself, I say, okay, I would have been very upset that this guy said this about my wife sitting there. I'd have been very upset. I think I would have felt the impulse to punch him in the face. I don't know that walking up on the stage and doing it would have been the thing to do. I don't know. In that moment, that's when you really want to respond, right? In that moment as it happens. So there's a lot of people, when you listen to all the commentary, that are saying, hey, you know, Will Smith was upset. He did the right thing. He you know, defended his wife. And then other people are saying it was totally inappropriate to do it that way, to walk up on the stage and hit the guy. And I don't know. I think it was in the moment. I honestly believe it was in the moment. But if you watch, go back and look this up. You can see it on YouTube. There's lots of different places that are showing it. Chris Rock makes the joke, and you'll notice. Watch him. Watch his body language. Watch how he speaks, the words he says, the inflection on his face. And this is where, looking at that, I didn't believe he was really doing it to hurt the woman. I don't think he knew she had a health issue. I think she thought it was a beauty thing she was doing, shaving her head. And he made the joke, and even Will Smith was laughing. You know, oh, that's pretty fun. And then you could see his wife, Jada Pinkett Smith, there. She, all of a sudden, she frowned. You can see her body language. She tenses up. She sits back. Her face contorts. Obviously, she was embarrassed that this kind of a thing would be brought up. And at that point, the camera goes back to Chris Rock, and you just see from the back Will Smith walking up on the stage. Now, at that point, you watch the confrontation. I don't think Chris Rock thought he was going to get smacked in the face, because he's saying, uh-oh, here he comes. He's coming up here. And then he lets loose and gives him a shot in the face. So why was Will Smith laughing when the joke was made, and then 2 minutes later he's running up on the stage to smack this guy in the face? Well, if you watch from other angles, you can see that there's this look that his wife gives him, like, can you believe he just said that to me? Now, is that possible, that you didn't realize she would be so hurt by it? And once you realized she was hurt by it, uh-oh, that's not right. I have to do something about it. Because he laughed. He did laugh. And it was a real genuine laugh. Read his body language. It was a real genuine laugh. made by, you know, a comedian, a comment by a comedian. But then up he goes, and he does what he does. So there's more to the story, obviously, but there are two different sides here that people are taking. One, he did the right thing as a husband to defend his wife, and other people saying he shouldn't have resorted to violence like that. He should have handled it in a different way. I don't know. When you're put in that position, depending on lots of factors here. Let's look at, and I don't know the personal things about their relationship, Will Smith and his wife. I don't know. I've only heard the same stories you've probably heard. They have an open marriage, that she had an affair on him, that he was aware of it, and who knows? You add all those personal things into people's interactions with each other, and that changes the dynamics. So that's all possible. You know, that could have been going on in the background. Was there alcohol involved? You know, was he sitting there having a couple of drinks? We all know with alcohol, we can change how we behave. You know, there are some people, when you drink, you're either a lover or a fighter. Some people could become very hands-on and touchy-feely, and they love everybody. And then there's other people that become aggressive and negative and are always looking to pick fights and have nasty comments for people or whatever. Who knows? Was that a factor? But this thing really is between Chris Rock, Will Smith, and Jada Pinkett Smith. And apparently, Chris Rock has apologized, and Will Smith has apologized for what he did, and Jada Pinkett Smith has made a comment that, you know, she understands it's between them, and that should be the end of it. The cultural questions are the things that we can look at. You know, I haven't heard anybody coming up and saying, you know, who is he to, you know, stand up for his wife? Why didn't she stand up for herself? Why didn't she say something or do something? And maybe she would have afterwards. Maybe she would have handled it differently, is the question. But that's been out there in the public eye for a while, and I just wanted to touch base on it. Now, another relationship kind of thing along that, cultural. There's a lot of cultural things here. We see Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, his wife, Virginia, apparently was text messaging the Trump chief of staff, imploring him not to give up on the election during the election returns as they were coming in. And when you listen to her commentary, apparently she's a very conservative woman. She believes in conservative causes. And she, like many, many, many people in the country, didn't feel that the election was being run fairly, properly, or appropriately, and that things were not right with how the votes were being tabulated, how they were being connected. And she was doing her right to free speech. She was texting, which is a personal communication with someone she knew, and saying, hey, don't give in. Let the facts come in first. We can't let this happen. So now, of course, we're seeing our friends on the left are losing their minds because they don't like Clarence Thomas to begin with, because he's a conservative African-American man, and that doesn't fit the narrative of how they want to see our African-American brothers and sisters. They should all be liberal and believe, you know, that everybody's out to get them. And Clarence Thomas doesn't live by that kind of a lifestyle. He's one of the most brilliant men, brilliant Americans we have ever seen come across the public stage. And they don't like him for that reason, so they're trying to get rid of him. They see a potential here on the court with it 6-3 more conservative, although, you know, John Roberts doesn't really strike me as a conservative anymore. He's more of a flip-flop liberal. But even then, it would be 5-4 conservative court, and they can't abide by that. They have 3 more years to try and get a couple of more justices on there. And one of the ways that they're looking at is packing the court. Hey, let's just, we own the Congress and the presidency. Let's say the Supreme Court should be 15, and we'll put on, you know, 6 more very liberal judges, and then it'll be, 9-5 or whatever it would be in every case that comes forward. Manipulating the court, basically. But what we're seeing here is that a lot of our friends on the left, including AOC, who came out with a lengthy tweet, that not only should Justice Thomas recuse himself from any judgments on the January 6th riot in Washington, but he should resign from the bench because of what his wife had to say. So this is where the cultural situation comes in here. First of all, should Clarence Thomas control what his wife does? Isn't that an old-fashioned kind of thought, that a husband would control the things his wife would say and do, and that that would be something he should step in and tell her how to behave? Or is she an autonomous citizen who has a right to make her commentary and it doesn't affect him? Number two, if for anybody's out there that's married, you know when you have a conversation, you don't always agree on everything with your spouse or your significant other. And just because your significant other thinks that Cheerios is the best cereal, you might like oatmeal. Doesn't mean you change what you eat just because your spouse wants you to do it, right? So I don't know how much influence she would have over Clarence Thomas because she thought it was a bad election, that it was stolen, that there was improprieties, illegalities, which slowly but surely are coming out. There was illegalities. Things were done inappropriately. The courts have refused to address them, so therefore the situation stands. I'm not going to say, I'm not saying we're overturning any election. The election happened. What we should do is learn from it. When you have constitutional barriers to how elections are run, as we saw in many places like Pennsylvania, where the legislature has to enact law to change how the votes are taken, and they don't do that, then that certainly disenfranchised many of the citizens of the state of Pennsylvania. The fact that the court wouldn't look at it doesn't mean nothing was wrong. They just chose not to look at it. We should fix these things before the next presidential election. We still have 3 years. So whatever you think about what happened in that election, we should fix the problems. So Clarence Thomas's wife, Virginia, she was imploring someone she knew, a personal friend, an acquaintance, via a personal message, a text message, to not give in. Don't give in yet. Keep fighting, because if this was wrong, we could prove it. Now, at the time, if you remember, at the time, the arguments were being made that because there was improprieties in how these states were running their elections, you know, the paper balloting, the mail-in balloting, changing the pickup points, all these things, that by law in each one of those states, by law, could not be done. And they were doing it anyway. That seemed like a reasonable thing to say. Hey, they didn't follow their law. So therefore, this was contaminated. This was wrong. We have to fix this. There should be some remedy. That's what was going on. Now, the courts subsequently, for whatever reason, decided they weren't going to address those issues. And if you were a person who was disenfranchised because of it, oh, well, you got disenfranchised. You know, figure it out next time. Which you can all say is right or is wrong. But whatever it is, it's what happened. And we have to deal with it. But we should fix it going forward. But should Clarence Thomas have to step down from his seat on the bench because his wife had some commentary? Is that what we do now? If somebody in your family says something that is not popular, you have to suffer consequences? Well, the thing that we're hearing in lots of places is, well, the immediate obvious connection would be, if that was true, if that's the standard we're going to go by now, with all the controversy around Hunter Biden and his laptop and his crazy money and the grift and all that kind of stuff that they're investigating, shouldn't Joe Biden have to take responsibility for that and step down? Shouldn't his whole family have to step away from everything because of what his son did? No, of course not. And neither should Clarence Thomas. He should not have to step down off the bench because his wife has a political opinion. Now, Clarence Thomas is also very conservative. I'm sure he probably had the same kinds of feelings. He's one of the only three justices who, at the time, voted to take on those cases, because you have to have four justices agree to take a case, as I understand it. And we only had three. So therefore, that's why the court didn't take up any of these issues. Clarence Thomas was one of them, one of the justices that said, yeah, we should look at this because down the road, we're going to get these cases anyway. So we should step in now before there's a problem and determine if legislatures can do this against their own laws, if they can break their own laws to change the voting processes. If that is acceptable, well, let's judge on it now, and then it won't come up again in the future. That was his point. But he couldn't get another justice to join him, and therefore they didn't hear the cases. Doesn't mean what happened was right and legal. What it means is the court decided not to hear it. Now, whether it comes up again in the future, I would think every state should be looking at that right now to try and fix that before the next election, because if not, we're going to have another mess, right? We're going to have another mess in our next election. So does Clarence Thomas own his wife? Does he have a right to tell her what to do and say? No, of course not. This is our modern world. So do you see the cultural problem here? That people want to say, you know, we're both autonomous partners in this relationship. No one can tell anybody what to do, like back in the day they used to do, right? Husband would tell his wife, knock it off, don't do this, don't do that. And that was accepted as culturally norm, and we've changed that now. We are independent individuals who have our own opinions, who can do what we want, can get work, can do whatever you want to do in life. And that is celebrated in most instances. But here, it does not really seem to be celebrated, does it? No, his wife said something that they want to conflate into, and this they are conflating it. All she was saying was, wait till the facts come in. Don't give up. Stand strong for the law. For the law. How dare you stand strong for the law? What they've conflated it to is that his wife was taking an active part in the rebellion against the Congress, you know, the attack on our constitutional way of life. That's how they're framing it. I guess we should be lucky that like six people listen to these left-wing TV stations and the American people are not falling for that. But that was another cultural thing that we saw. Where else do we see cultural things? And this is where people get in trouble delving into cultural things. What have we seen recently? How about the controversy over Governor DeSantis down in Florida? Boy, are they going to keep going after this guy? Because it's been pretty much made clear by Donald Trump that if he does run again, he's not running with Michael Pence. So he'd be looking for another running mate. Now, you would think that that would be a powerful, powerful team of Trump and DeSantis. And then there's also the concern that, well, DeSantis might want to run on his own. He might want to run as the presidential candidate, and those two could have a conflict. We've already heard about conflicts between their camps and, you know, just because of that, because he's the heir apparent after Trump. DeSantis would be a very strong character. You know, we've seen that since he probably will look for a running mate that is pro-Trump, you know, because, you know, having Mike Pence, who obviously came on board and seemed to do, he seemed like a very decent man. I think he's a very good person. But he didn't buy into the whole Trump thing either when push came to shove. And I think that's why Trump would push him, is pushing him off the ticket if he was going to run. But Governor DeSantis, they're trying to pre-destroy him before he even gets an opportunity to be a national popular candidate. They attack everything at the pandemic, that he was going to kill people, that he wanted to murder people with no masks, and he wanted to murder people with not making them take vaccines they didn't want to take and all that. And it turns out Florida's economy is booming. The people of Florida are healthy. The pandemic basically stopped there months and months and months ago. I've been to Florida several times during the pandemic. And as soon as you get off that airplane, you take that mask off, you were back in a normal world. Now, does that mean that COVID is not dangerous, that COVID would not kill you, that COVID will not hurt you bad? Yes, it does. It's a bad disease. It's a dangerous disease. So recently we see Dr. Fauci, who has disappeared off the stage for a while, because as the midterm elections come up, I think our friends on the left want to step away as far as they can from this controversy, which is really unpopular. The masking is unpopular. The vaccines is unpopular. And they're seeing, you know, nobody wants to be locked down anymore. So they're going to start stepping away. So you got to get rid of that guy. Got to get him off the stage because his constant commentary that, you know, wear your mask, wear three masks, lockdown, right? Is not a good message for them. So we kind of seen him on the sideline until recently. He just popped up the other day and I saw him and he says, hey, listen, you know, the coronavirus is bad. COVID is bad. And then we got these variants that'll kill everybody. Well, then we got the Omicron variant and it wasn't that bad. You could get it. And it was very bad for some people, but it wasn't that bad. And we could see, that, hey, we could survive this. You know, it's watering itself down, which is a natural process of a virus. Each wave gets less and less deadly, maybe more catchable, so to speak, but less deadly. Well, now we have this. There's another one now. There's another variant brewing out there that apparently is even less than Omicron, but it's giving him an opportunity to come back on the stage. And what's he say? Hey, we have to be prepared. We have to be prepared. He says, I don't want to say lockdowns because people don't like the word lockdown. Maybe we have to take more precautions, which is a nice way of saying we have to lock down again. So that's in the background. Now, why would somebody want to lock down again? Well, there's only a couple of reasons. One, because exposure to the virus will kill so many people, and it's a health risk to everyone. Now, hospitals will be full, and you won't be able to get in for emergencies because everyone's, you know, in there is with COVID. Or two, we have these elections coming up, and we have to strike panic in people's faces. We have to make sure we can control how the voting is done. And what better way to do it than to have another variant where we can jump up and say, everyone has to lock down. You have to do these paper ballots. We have to do whatever. I don't know. I'm not that conspiracy guy, but there's also things are done for real. There are operations that are done, you know, covert ops. There are background plans of how to do things. And we saw how people responded. How did our fellow citizens respond to these lockdowns? You still have people today riding around in their car by themselves with a mask on. You still see people today down at the beach, nobody around them but the fish in the sea, and they're swimming around and they got a mask on. The fear factor that has been pushed into people is going to be very hard to remove completely. And we're seeing that. Does that have a benefit to anyone? Who would benefit from such a thing? And that's, you know, that's just like follow the money. When you're investigating a crime, follow the money. It'll tell you who the players are. Well, when we look at this, when we see Florida doing great, thriving, surviving, and other places still locked down, we have to say, why? Follow the who benefits from those kind of things. All right. The other thing with DeSantis, he just recently signed this parental rights bill into law. Now, big controversy over this, because we have people who are saying that they're calling it the "Don't Say Gay" bill in school. You can't talk about being gay in school. It's banning gay. It's in other words, it is anti-LGBTQ, and it is anti-gay, and it's a hate speech law, and it's meant for hate speech Republicans who hate all these kind of people, and that's not it at all. That's not it at all. It has brought up another cultural consideration that we have to look at. We know that progressive policy, progressives on the left, see control over everything, every part of your life, as is important to them. They want to tell you what you can eat, the food you can eat, how you can eat it, how much of it you can eat. They want to tell you what kind of vaccines you have to take. They want to tell you what you have to do to go out in public. They want to tell you where you can and can't go. They're very controlling, our friends on the left. They really want to control many, many aspects of your life. And this is no different. They are proponents, and I'm going to give them this credit. I'm going to say they are trying to protect a constituency that they believe has been victimized over the years. And that would be our LGBTQ community. Many of our gay Americans feel like they're being attacked, that they don't have the and historically, were they attacked? Yes, they were. So I kind of understand their concern for that group, to make sure that they get to live their life in peace, that they get to live their life as they choose to live, that they get to live their life without being derided and attacked. None of that should happen. As I have said here thousands of times by now in these many years, it doesn't matter who you love. Love who you're going to love. It doesn't affect me. You do your thing, I'll do my thing. But going after little children, demanding that little children in pre-K, think about that, in pre-K through third grade be introduced into any kind of ideas about sexual activity, about relationships of a sexual nature. As a parent, that's not appropriate. I believe that's not appropriate. This school shouldn't be doing that. The school should be teaching my pre-K through third grader how to read, write, and do mathematics. That's what they should be teaching. Letting these kids interact with each other to learn how to be socially interactive so they can learn how to talk to other people, how they can express their opinions. That's what school should be teaching. But instead, many people see this as an opportunity to indoctrinate children at a young age into what they believe is correct. And again, I think they're doing it because they're trying to protect a constituency that they think needs protection. The problem is, it goes against what parents believe is right. And again, we look at this, the bigger picture, our friends on the left, the progressive thinking says, the state knows better than you. The state knows better than you because you're a hater, because you hate people. We should be able to teach the children what we think is important, not what you think at home, because you might not like people who have different lifestyles than you. You might hate those people, and therefore, we should be able to teach your children what's right, not what you think at home. And that's kind of the way it comes across. But that's not it at all. Think about this. Pre-K children, 4 years old to third grade, right? So what would that make them? Kindergarten, year five, say up to 8 years old. I wouldn't talk to them about any kind of sexual thing. I would talk to them about making friends with people. I would talk to them about getting along with everybody, about solving their problems if they have an argument with little Mary or little Bobby, right? That's what I would talk to them about. And I would teach them how to read, how to write, and how to do mathematics. That's the kind of things I would teach those young children, help them develop their intellect. Now, as they get older, there could be times to discuss these things. These are cultural things. These are real things that we do need to talk about. I don't know if school is always the most appropriate place because you get bias of people. Just like our friends on the left don't want parents having a right to say these things because parents might be haters. Well, you might have people on the other side that go the wrong way, and they have the right to say things to our children. School is about learning, and I understand that culturally, these kind of things, if they're brought in and they're put in perspective, it can help young people get a good perspective so that we can wipe out hatred, right? We can wipe out, false thoughts about what other people are doing. So we can let everybody just live their life without picking on people. That's important. I get it. But 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds? No, that's a parent's decision. That is not a school district's decision. That's a parent's decision. So while this bill is labeled as the Don't Say Gay bill, it doesn't say that at all. That's how it's been labeled to act like a hammer against people who support this bill. And all they're supporting is that the parents have a right to say what their children will be exposed to. Right? Think about it this way. How would all the people who are against this bill, who hate the idea that they can't talk to these children at 4 years old about sexuality against the parents' will, how would they like it if we taught about religion and we taught about God's place in the world and we taught about the Ten Commandments? I think they would react a little differently, because right now they're saying that this DeSantis bill is attacking free speech. You're attacking the free speech of the teachers who want to talk about these things to the kids. Well, what if there was teachers that wanted to talk about religion and religion's place in life and sin and how we're doing things wrong, right? Do you think they would be like, hey, listen, that's free speech. I should think you should let them talk about it. No, that would be immediately crushed and stopped. So this topic in this bill is no different. Parents have a right to be a part of what their children are taught in school. It's as simple as that. So there's some things to think about today here on Chasing Justice. You know, where do you stand on all of this? Until we meet again, remember, be a part of the solution, not a part of the problem. This is Lieutenant Joe for Chasing Justice here on the America Out Loud Radio Network.